The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday. It is July the 7th, 2026. It is 9 minutes past 10 in the morning here in London, England, making it 9 minutes past 11 in the morning over in Cape Town, South Africa, where my dear friend Dr. Peter Hammond is. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
Good morning. Yes, thank you, Andrew. I'm with you.
Good morning, Peter. And Peter was away last week, you may remember, and he's going to tell us all about that because Peter never misses the opportunity to spread the word of God, and that is what he was up to last week. So we're going to get into that later. But before we do that, we're going to get into the main body of the show, which is continuing our study of the Bible. We're in the Old Testament. Today is the real story of Habakkuk. And don't forget Peter's Old Testament survey books, which it's the Old Testament survey book and the New Testament survey, along with many other books that we're going to get into, one of them particular later today in our film review, Holocaust in Rwanda. But that being said, Peter, where would you like to start us off today? Sorry, the websites are in the post for this show at achshow.com. And where would you like to start us off today with the real story of Habakkuk?
Well, Habakkuk is of great relevance to us today. It deals with very difficult questions that I'm sure many of us have asked. Why do the innocent suffer? Why do the guilty go free? Why does God not punish the wicked now? How can a holy God overlook the wickedness all around us? So these are the questions that Habakkuk wrestles with. And Habakkuk means one who embraces. And this is actually a wrestling term. It's not a consolation term. Habakkuk worked in a temple in Jerusalem, and he was a contemporary of the prophets Jeremiah and Ezekiel, of Daniel and of Zephaniah. So Habakkuk ministered during the final days of the Assyrian Empire and at the beginning of the rise of Babylon as a world power. And Habakkuk had lived through the reforms of King Josiah in 2 Kings 22 and 2 Kings 23. And it was King Josiah who had abolished many of the idolatrous practices of his father Ammon and of his grandfather Manasseh. And the empire of Assyria had fallen, just as Nahum had promised. And Egypt and Babylon were contending for dominance. And so in 605 BC, the good King Josiah had been killed at the Battle of Carmarthen. And the burden of Habakkuk was published during the early years of the reign of King Jehoiakim. It was a time of increasing moral and spiritual deterioration in Judah, the southern kingdom of Judah. And the evil reign of Jehoiakim was a sad contrast to the days before him under his father, King Josiah, who was a good king. So the book of Habakkuk is set in a dialogue form, just as the book of Job is. And Habakkuk believed in interrogatory prayer. Intercessory prayers when we ask God for things. Lord, please do this and please give us this and so on. That's intercessory prayer. Interrogatory prayers when we ask God questions. And Habakkuk complains to God about the violence, the iniquity, the trouble, the plundering throughout Habakkuk chapter 1. And the malicious wickedness by those who are meant to be God's people, this surely demands action from God. The law is powerless. Justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, and therefore perverse judgments proceed. So we could be complaining like this today. This sounds very up to date. Habakkuk had trouble reconciling his faith in a good, righteous, just, and all-powerful God with the prevalent wickedness in Jerusalem. He was troubled with an eternal why. Why does a holy God allow such terrible crimes to go unpunished? And why do the wicked seem to prosper? And why does God seem to be silent in times of disaster? And so you can see the structure of Habakkuk. In chapter 1, Habakkuk is grappling with the problems of wickedness. In chapter 2, Habakkuk is grasping the significance of God's judgment. And in chapter 3, Habakkuk is glorying in God's sovereignty. Habakkuk was confused. He was bewildered. He had lived during the days of the Great Reformation under King Josiah. He had seen the Empire of Assyria collapse. But now he was seeing the rise of another wicked power, Babylon. The world seemed to be in upheaval. Violence was abounding and lawlessness was prevalent. God's people were being oppressed, and blatant idolatry was replacing the worship of the one true God. Justice was being subverted, and therefore perverse judgment abounds or proceeds. So God responds to the prophet Habakkuk, "Look among the nations and watch, be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, even though it was told you. For indeed I'm raising up the Chaldeans," that's the Babylonians, "terrible and dreadful, fierce. They all come for violence." And so that's in Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 5 to 9. God says that he's raising another wicked nation to punish the previous wicked nation, Assyria. And Habakkuk is astounded and he's dismayed. "But the Babylonians seem even worse than the Assyrians. Are you not from everlasting? O Lord, my God, my Holy One, you are of purer eyes than to behold evil." Now, many people have quoted that like it's true, but Habakkuk wasn't right. God does see everything. You know, "you're of purer eyes than to behold evil" has been misinterpreted to mean God cannot see evil, but God does see everything. He is omniscient. He is all-knowing, and he's omnipresent. He's everywhere present. So this verse of Habakkuk is quoted often as truth, whereas it's not truth. It's just a complaint of Habakkuk, which was actually false. Habakkuk was burdened with his backslidden people and his broken world, and Habakkuk knew that God must judge evil. So how could a holy God use wicked people such as the Babylonians to fulfill his purposes? How could a holy God use such a wicked nation as the Chaldeans to judge a nation like Judah, which was not even nearly as bad as those who continue to slay nations without pity? So Habakkuk declares that he'll go up to the watchtower and he'll stand on the ramparts to await the answer of the Lord, to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected. And the Lord responds by commanding Habakkuk to write the vision and to make it plain on tablets. So God tells Habakkuk he is achieving nothing by sitting on the watchtower. He needs to go down into the streets and he needs to write. He needs to warn the people, and he needs to write and warn. And God tells him to get the passersby to read. Habakkuk needs to be warning the people, not sitting at a distance to watch. And he thought his best duty was to watch, but God says, no, your duty is to write and to warn and to see what God will do, and he will do what he has promised. So God declares five woes upon the Chaldeans or the Babylonians. First is against their injustice. The Chaldeans are plundering nations by extortion. They are hoarding the fruits of other people's labors. What increases what is not his? They increase what is not theirs. And God hates theft. God hates robbery. Unjust weights and measures are an abomination to God. And secondly, God condemns the Babylonians with another woe on their covetousness. Woe to him who covets unjust gain. You give shameful counsel to your house, cutting off many people, and you sin against your own soul. So greed and envy will reap judgment. And because he enlarged his desire to hell, and he is like death, and he cannot be satisfied. And thirdly, a woe is pronounced on Babylon for the bloodshed. Woe to him who builds a town with bloodshed, who establishes a city by iniquity. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people. And the fourth woe is for the drunkenness. Woe to him who gives alcoholic drink to his neighbor, pressing him to the bottle, even to make him drunk. For the violence done in Lebanon will cover you, and the plunder of beasts which made them afraid, because of men's blood and the violence in the land and the city, and of all who dwell in it. The destruction of the forest of Lebanon, the mass killing of animals for ivory, tusks, and skins, the Lord will call men to account for this. God has forbidden the chopping down of fruit trees during time of war. Drunkenness, debauchery, and destruction of God's forests and God's creatures, this will all be judged. And idolatry is the fifth woe. Those who worship man-made idols made out of wood and stone and metal and ivory are ignoring the one true God. Idolatry is the most condemned sin in the Bible. No sin is condemned as wholeheartedly as that of idolatry. But then Habakkuk 2:20 says, but the Lord is in his temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. So raising up the Babylonians to judge his wicked people does not mean that God will allow the Babylonians to get away with their evil. Make no mistake, Babylon will be judged. But first, God is going to use Babylon to judge Judah and Jerusalem. And on the shores of Galilee, Christ pronounced a curse on three towns. Woe to you, Capernaum. Woe to you, Bethsaida. Woe to you, Chorazin. However, the Lord did not pronounce any woe against Tiberias. If you go to the Lake of Galilee today, you'll have to stay in Tiberias because all the other towns that Jesus declared woes against have disappeared. Babylon will be covered in shame, but the earth will be covered with God's glory. Babylon's glory will be covered with shame because of their drunken debauchery, their shameful conduct, their ruthless exploitation, their plundering of nations, the extorting of people and the destroying of forests and wildlife. God will cover Babylon with shame and utterly destroy them. But Habakkuk 2:14 says, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Habakkuk 2:4, behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. The proud trust in himself. However, the righteous trust in God. The just shall live by faith. And the Apostle Paul uses Habakkuk 2:4 as a foundational text for his proclamation of the gospel in the book of Romans. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. True saving faith is supernatural. It is a gracious gift of God that he produces in the regenerate heart. Only by means of God's grace, received by faith, can a person appropriate and experience true righteousness. Sin is incompatible with God's holiness. How can a holy God allow sinful people like you and I into his heaven? Only by divine intervention. The cross of Christ and the final judgment are fulfillments of this revelation in the book of the prophet Habakkuk. Habakkuk can be called a forerunner of the Reformation. This verse in Habakkuk 2:4, as explained by the Apostle Paul in Romans, influenced the reformers, particularly Dr. Martin Luther and John Calvin. The just shall live by faith became watchwords and battle cries for the Reformation, proclaiming the foundational doctrine of the justification by faith. The word in Hebrew used for faith in Habakkuk 2:4 also means faithfulness, indicating an ongoing condition of walking and living by faith, not just by one token act of commitment once. This is living the just shall live by faith, not just have a public commitment. It's more than raising a hand in a service. It's more than walking the aisle once. This is a matter of lifestyle. And so faith is plainly not a one-time act of token commitment. Faith is a way of life. A true believer will habitually persevere in faith throughout his life. The just shall live by faith. In Galatians, the Apostle Paul again refers to this key verse in Habakkuk. For as many of the works of the law are under the curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone who doesn't continue in all the things which are written in the book of the law to do them. But that no one is justified by the law in the sight of God is evident, for the just shall live by faith. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He does not say unto seeds as of many, but as of one, to your seed, who is Christ. And this I say, that the law, which was 430 years later, cannot allow the covenant that was confirmed before God in Christ, that it should make the promise of no effect. For if the inheritance is of the law, it is no longer promise, but God gave it to Abraham by promise. This is all in Galatians chapter 3. Galatians 3:24 says, therefore the law was our tutor, our schoolmaster, to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. The Chaldeans, drunk with the blood of nations that they plundered, shall in time be destroyed. Yet God's people will flourish, and the glory of the Lord will fill the earth. The wicked are doomed. However, for God there is a glorious future. What man means for evil, God can use for good. All things work together for good for those that love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. God's thoughts are higher than our thoughts. His ways are higher above our ways. That's all in Isaiah 55, verse 9. So Habakkuk confirms that, yes, the world is full of suffering and evil. We live in a fallen world. However, it is not wrong to ask hard questions of God. It is good to think through our faith. It is good to face questions which life throws at us. And there's a lot of those. However, although we may not always understand what God is doing behind the scenes, we can be absolutely confident of his eternal purposes. We may not understand God's will, but we can trust it. Much of man's wickedness fails to receive justice on earth in this life. That is true. However, the problem of suffering points us beyond this life to the next life. There is a day of judgment coming. The eternal creator, our eternal judge, will call all to account, and he will put all things right at the end, either through justice or mercy. But Habakkuk reveals much about the character of God. God is holy. God is just. God is sovereign. God is unchanging. God is merciful. He is the savior. He is the judge. He is the revealer of truth. Jesus is the God of my salvation. All of that we get in Habakkuk. The prophet responds to God's revelation with a heartfelt prayer for revival. O Lord, I've heard your speech and I was afraid. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. That's Habakkuk 3 verse 2. So the third chapter is a prophecy actually set to music. Now Moses and Deborah, Samuel, Saul, Elijah, Ezekiel and David, they all set psalms to music. But this is fairly rare amongst the prophets. But it is here in Habakkuk chapter 3. There's a tremendous change between chapters 1 and 2 of Habakkuk and chapter 3 in Habakkuk. In chapters 1 to 2, we see Habakkuk wrestling with God. In chapter 3, we see Habakkuk resting in God. In chapters 1 to 2, we see Habakkuk miserable. Whereas in chapter 3, we see Habakkuk the prophet joyful. In chapters 1 to 2, it seems that the prophet is shouting. But in chapter 3, the prophet is singing. Chapters 1 to 2 are prayer, whereas chapter 3 is praise. Habakkuk chapter 1 to 2 is impatient, whereas in Habakkuk 3, you can see the prophet is patient. In Habakkuk 1 to 3, we see Habakkuk the prophet asking for justice, whereas in chapter 3, we see the prophet asking for mercy. Habakkuk chapters 1 to 2 are full of depression, whereas Habakkuk 3 is full of rejoicing. In Habakkuk 1 to 2, it would appear that God seems to be apparently inactive or silent, whereas in Habakkuk chapter 3, we see God is active in the past and he's active in the future. So Habakkuk 3 ends with a hymn of praise and trust in the Lord and a doxology. The glory and brightness of God's light is celebrated. His power is recognized, even in pestilence, even during fever and afflictions, even in his anger and wrath. The weapons of God are recognized in his bow and his arrows, in his chariots of salvation. His spears, his earthquakes, the floods, the trampling of nations in anger and wrath. To the whirlwind, and you have walked through the sea, that I might rest in the day of trouble, when he comes up to the people. He will invade them with his troops. All that we get in Habakkuk chapter 3. And so we've got this wonderful verse in Habakkuk, which we've probably all sung. Though the fig tree may not blossom, nor fruit beyond the vine, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food, yet the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet will I rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like a deer's feet. He will make me walk on the high hills. That's Habakkuk 3, 17 to 19. Joy is a choice in spite of our circumstances. Those who sow in tears will reap with joy. He who continually goes forth weeping, bearing seed for sowing, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. That's in Psalm 126, which we might have also sung. Even if everything that was normal and peaceful collapses, the prophet will still rejoice in the Lord for who God is, not only for what God does. Even on precipitous mountain heights, we can trust God to make our feet as sure as the deer, the sure-footed as a deer. And I've climbed Table Mountain and seen these mountain goats, these Himalayan tars, suddenly bouncing around as though they're walking on a highway, and they're just jumping from little, maybe it's a coin-sized spot of stability in the rock that they can jump on, and bouncing all over the place. Absolutely amazing what is possible. So the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. God imparts strength, God imparts skill, and God imparts steadfastness to his servants. Hebrews 10 says, for you have need of endurance, so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come, and he will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, even if everyone draws back. My soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition. We are of those who believe and to the saving of our souls. And so probably a verse that can sum up the great message of Habakkuk is Habakkuk 2 verse 14. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now, the first time I saw this verse, I thought, you know, 60% of the world is covered by water. So maybe we can see 60% of the world evangelized. But that's not what Habakkuk 2:14 is saying. It's saying, for the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Not as the waters cover the earth, as the waters cover the sea. Well, what percentage of the sea is covered by water? I think we can all agree about 100%. So we can expect the world to be 100% evangelized and the glory of the knowledge of the Lord to cover the earth as completely as the waters now cover the sea. So Habakkuk, while it starts with complaints, it ends in rejoicing and in celebration. It ends in singing and praise with patient rejoicing, seeking mercy and resting in God. Because God is active in past and God is active in the present, and he will continue to be active in the future. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Peter. And as I mentioned earlier, Peter was unable to join us last Tuesday, but he was busy spreading the word of God. Peter, what were you up to last Tuesday?
To minister in KwaZulu-Natal, what many people know as Zululand. Now, maybe some of your listeners have seen the film Zulu or Zulu Dawn, and you've got a bit of an idea of the people I was ministering amongst. Now, what those films wouldn't tell you is that after the Zulus suffered defeat at the Battle of Eastern Lwana and at Rooks Drift and Blood River, they didn't suffer defeat at Eastern Lwana. That was their victory. But Zulus started to come to Christ in great numbers and to amongst the Zulus. There's books out, God Amongst the Zulus, Revival Amongst Zulus. It's an extraordinary story. There's a mission station in the heart of Zululand, Kwasi Sabantu Mission, which literally means the place that helps people in the Zulu language. Kwa, place, Caesar, that helps, Bantu, people. Kwasi Sabantu, place that helps people. I've been a guest there many times over the last 40 years, and Kwasi Sibantu Mission is a place of revival. It's a phenomenal work. It grew out of a Lutheran mission station, and the work of Reverend Erlo Stegen, a German missionary, who has done such a phenomenal work, and this work continues so amazingly. I was able to minister to something like 8,000 young people gathered in the auditorium in this Kwasi Sibantu Mission and proclaiming the gospel. These people are hungry, enthusiastic. Many young people come forward and stay behind for counseling, to be led to Christ and prayed with afterwards. And it was a wonderful time. We had sports day. We had all kinds of activities there. The soccer was particularly popular. As you can imagine, it's a very popular sport in Africa. But what was so great was lives changed. And hearing testimonies of people, even people who have been involved in witchcraft, converted to Christ, people who are involved in all kinds of crimes and thefts, doing restitution, coming and restoring what they have stolen and seeking to make right with parents that they've been ostracized from and so on. So we can see lives transformed, and there's always a lot of great testimonies. So I was able to proclaim the word, distribute gospel literature, deliver Bibles and books to this mission station, which are our best friends and greatest inspiration. I think it's the most blessed mission station on the continent of Africa, if not in the world. So it's a joy to be there, because you can see prayers answered, miracles taking place. Just imagine the logistics, transporting people from every corner of South Africa to this event in KwaZulu and hosting the people. So they're providing three meals a day to thousands of young people. The auditorium can seat 10,000, and there were at least 8,000 people in the auditorium, absolutely packed and in some cases overflowing. Phenomenal amount of responses. And the theme was, above all else, guard your heart, from Proverbs chapter 4. Else, guard your heart, for out of it flow the wellspring of life. And I preached the message, the heart of the problem is the problem of the heart, which is available on our sermon audio on our frontlinemissionsa.org website. And there's a video of it as well as an audio. And I must say, I'll be posting pictures soon of the phenomenal crowds and the enthusiastic response of these Zulu young people. Now, the people came from all over the place. There were Americans there. There were people from the Congo. There were people from Zimbabwe and Zambia, from Swaziland, Namibia, Botswana. So people came from quite far, right? I even met Russian people there. There were people from Romania. So it's a bit of an international event, even though it's in KwaZulu, Zululand in South Africa. But there's quite an international attendance. Most of the people who would have been from South Africa, though, most of those even from Zululand itself. But there was translation, simultaneous translation into German, into French. There's simultaneous translation into Sotho and Tswana and other different languages there. So plainly, God is doing a great work at this time, and it was a privilege to be part of that. So I was there for this last week, got back late Sunday night, and just the Sunday morning service was quite remarkable as well. Phenomenal attendance, people from all over, and hear the choirs. The choirs, some of these choirs have hundreds of people participating in them. So like the massed choir and the combined choirs, and young people, brass bands, and the people are singing. There's a lot of singing because God has given us a reason to sing, given us a message to share. And so praise God for God amongst the Zulus and for what he's doing at Kwasi Sibantu Mission. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Peter. And we're going to move on now. During our last show together, Peter reviewed the film The Killing Fields. And what they tend to do with these big budget films is they'll take a big historical event like that was what happened under the communist Pol Pot regime in Cambodia. And that was what I wanted to see. I wanted to see a film which was like a documentary of what went on, but it was acted out by professional actors. But instead, what they do is they'll give you like a microcosm, like they centred on the relationship between an American journalist and some guy, Cambodian guy out there, rather than telling the big picture. They call it a microcosm, a miniature representative model of a larger entity or system, according to the definition I've got here on Google. And the film we're going to get into today takes a similar approach. It's called Hotel Rwanda, and I'm going to give you the first couple of lines it says on the Amazon review. Solidly built around a subtle yet commanding performance by Don Cheadle, Hotel Rwanda emerged as one of the most highly praised dramas of 2004. In a role that demands his quietly riveting presence in nearly every scene, Cheadle plays real-life hero Paul Rusabagina, a hotel manager in the Rwandan capital of Kigali, who in 1994 saved 1,200 Rwandan guests from certain death during the genocidal clash between tribal Hutus, who slaughtered a million victims, and the horrified Tutsis, who found safe haven or died. So again, you can see that they've taken this important tragic historical event and focused it on what went on in this hotel as part of the conflict. Whereas Peter knows very much about this conflict. In fact, he wrote a book called Holocaust in Rwanda, and I'll give you the write-up from Amazon on this. On the 6th of April 1994, one of the most dreadful campaigns of mass murder was unleashed upon the Tutsi people of Rwanda. In just 100 days, more people had been slaughtered with machetes and clubs than had died from atomic weapons in all of history. The horrific massacres in homes, hospitals, churches, and on the streets are documented with shocking photographs in Holocaust in Rwanda. More importantly, the author, Dr. Peter Hammond, relates the events leading up to the intense and widespread violence and documents the reasons why this systematic slaughter was unleashed. Missionary Peter Hammond also examines the disgraceful involvement of liberal church leaders, gun control, media manipulation, the French and US governments, and the United Nations in the crisis. Most importantly, the lessons we need to learn from the genocide in Rwanda are clearly and courageously presented. So I don't understand, well, we do know why they wouldn't make a film of a book like this, but surely when people want to see films about important historical events, they want to see a film about the event, not just some little element of it. They want to see the big picture, as they say. So Peter, what can you tell us about your views on the film Hotel Rwanda, and how you'd like to elaborate in your research on the Rwandan event?
Well, first of all, I stayed in Hotel Millis Kelowna, so I actually stayed in the film that in the venue that the film is centered around, Hotel Rwanda. And the first thing I can tell you is it's not a single story building, it's a multi-story building. So they didn't film Hotel Rwanda in Rwanda. And that's quite obvious to me who travels throughout Africa, because I could see immediately that Hotel Rwanda was filmed in South Africa. And all the backdrop, the kinds of roads, everything, it was South African roads. Not only that, but there was no Rwandese in the whole film. Hotel Rwanda was entirely made up of actors from South Africa and America. There was not a single Rwandese in the film Hotel Rwanda. So that's a bit disturbing. There's good things to say about the Hotel Rwanda film. It's a carefully crafted film. It's well worth seeing, because even though it's set in one hotel in the capital city of Rwanda, it does give a bit of a microcosm, a zoom lens, yes. But it is true that there was this hotel manager, Paul Rusabagina. He is actually the assistant manager of the Millis Colonus Hotel. But by ingenuity and good connections and bribes and bluff, Paul did manage to save the lives of 1,238 Tutsis from the genocide. And it's an engrossing, it's a gripping, it's an uplifting film showing how one person can make a difference even amongst the worst conditions. But also misdirection, just like the Killing Fields, it doesn't really answer the question of who was doing this or why it was being done, not even to whom it was being done, really. And it's not very realistic either, because, for example, we meant to believe, with genocide raging all over around them and the sounds of people being murdered audibly, yet there's no prayer, there's no singing of hymns, there's no reading of the Bible in Hotel Rwanda. Hotel Rwanda is secular. They don't give any acknowledgement of the Christians who have been targeted, nor do they give any attention to the Christian expressions or obviously natural prayers that would come out of people surrounded by genocide and really who could die at any moment. So it's unrealistic. About the only Christian images you see in the film is some nuns holding some wooden crosses. But there's no prayer, there's no Bible reading, there's no Christian faith evident in the whole of the book or film, Hotel Rwanda, which is obviously not realistic. Like my mother, who was a nurse, she said, only in the movies do you have people going into major surgery in hospitals under anesthetic and so on without prayer. Said in real life, everyone prays before going into surgery, and you don't have people going without a prayer, without the chaplain in real life, even though in the movies it's routinely done like that, but that's not realistic. Or think of the cowboys, all the Western films. How many Western films? There's not a church in the town. There's not a minister that appears, even though there was a lot of evangelism taking place in the Wild West and on the frontier and in the very towns where so many of these movies are often set. And that's not realistic. Well, you also have confusion, like what you read about, what Wikipedia said about Hotel Rwanda. It speaks about the clash between the Hutus and the Tutsis. It wasn't a clash. A clash suggests both sides are armed and both sides are exacting casualties with the other. This was a genocide planned by the government, systematically organized, where they slaughtered over 1 million of their people, Tutsi minority, because of their tribal identity. And that is left out of the film. So the film, for example, starts off with things like this, a United Nations colonel announcing negotiations have replaced conflicts in Africa. And there's a big banner in the beginning of the film of peace, another one, peace, love, and brotherhood, UNAMIR 1994. And that just is not realistic. This was not a conflict between two sides. It was a genocide organized by the government and enabled by the United Nations. Now, that would make a bigger, more interesting, more nuanced film with more twists and turns, but they went for a more simplistic thing. UN good, UN means well, and you know, somehow or another there's race involved in tribalism and people are dying, but they leave out the fact this was a systematic, coordinated genocide, which involved the assassination of two presidents simultaneously, or for the Americans, should we say simultaneously. So the only time in history that two heads of state have been killed at the same time in the same event. As the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi were returning from peace talks in Tanzania, and their plane was shot down by a French heat-seeking missile used by the presidential guard of Rwanda. So this was proved by the Belgian United Nations investigating team that, in fact, the presidential guard had assassinated their own president, and the missile came from the presidential guard compound into the plane that was carrying the president of Rwanda and the president of Burundi. And this was used as the trigger, as the pretext, as the justification for the genocide. So this was not a clash. This was not the war. There was no war. This was a planned genocide where they even assassinated their own president in order to justify massacring many of their tribal enemies. And hundreds of thousands, ultimately 1.1 million Tutsi Christians, mostly Protestants, were slaughtered with machetes. And, you know, when you think in 6 weeks, more people were killed with machetes and with clubs than have died from atomic weapons in all of history. That's just staggering what was done. And this was organized, this was coordinated. Most of the massacres took place in churches, hospitals, and in schools, places that people would have thought were sanctuaries. So the moment the massacres occurred, people fled to sanctuaries, places they thought they'd be safe, like hospitals, schools, and churches. And that's where the government wanted them to go, because that's where they planned their mobs, their Interahamwe mobs, or hacked to death the people who fled there. The situation is so bad, most of the patients who were massacred in the Rwandese hospitals, like in Kigali, were killed by doctors and nurses. So Hutu doctors and nurses were slaughtering Tutsi patients. I went into the maternity ward, blood up the walls, the entire ward hacked to death. We're talking about pregnant women and young mothers with children, hacked to death by the gynecologists and the nurses in the gynecology ward and the maternity ward. Can you imagine? They don't tell you that in the film. They don't tell you that most of the people killed in the churches were killed by other church members, even overseen by bishops and cardinals and heads of denominations were involved. Hutu church leaders killing Tutsi church members. And same thing in the schools, that it was Hutu teachers and students killing the Tutsi students. And so the tribalism ran through the whole lot. And the United Nations, far from preventing this, actually enabled it. So I would recommend a better book and film is Shake Hands with the Devil. General Romeo Dallaire, who was the French-speaking Canadian general in charge of United Nations mission to Rwanda, UNIMIR, he disclosed that they knew about the genocide coming. He knew about the plans. He knew about how many people intend to kill in what amount of time and the weapons. And he planned to seize the red Chinese machetes that had been provided for the Inter-Ahmwe mass murderers. And he thought as a peacekeeper he could do this, but he was ordered by Kofi Annan, head of the United Nations Peacekeeping Operations Security Council, forbade him to intervene and seize the million machetes that had been imported into the country that was stockpiled in a warehouse before it could be distributed to the mobs. And he was ordered by the UN Secretary General not to interfere. Now, what good is our peacekeepers, who, by the way, had been there to help disarm the population? They removed weapons from the targeted victims, the Tutsi, to enable the government to massacre them. And here's the head of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in Rwanda, Romeo Dallaire, revealing in his book Shake Hands with the Devil, which was turned into a much better film. Shake Hands with the Devil was filmed in Rwanda with Rwandese actors at the very places where these things took place, with General Romeo Dallaire overseeing to ensure accuracy on all these matters, which documents how the French government was accessory before, during, and after the fact to the genocide, and were actually arming and training and preparing the people for it. And by the way, many of the architects of the genocide fled to France or to French-speaking parts of Canada, where they are escaping justice, because despite the French government signing the anti-genocide treaty, they have protected the genocidal architects because they speak French. You know, does that make sense? Like, okay, they're genocidal mass murderers, but they speak French. When the French foreign minister was asked, what is France doing? He said, we are holding the line for Francophone Africa against Anglophone Africa. Translation, the mass murdering Hutu government speak French. The Tutsi Christians being massacred speak English. Therefore, you know, this genocide's justified, basically. So I expose that in the book, Holocaust in Rwanda, the involvement of the French government. And the American State Department was also heavily involved because they were preventing the Security Council from acting. And General Romeo Dallaire documents how everything they asked for, ammunition, weapons, armored cars, food, for the refugees who had flooded the UN camps seeking protection, were being denied. And the US State Department was doing the most, because the Clinton presidency was objecting to the term genocide, because apparently you can't refer to genocide if you're referring to anything other than Jews in the Second World War, because nobody else can qualify for that term. It's apparently like copyrighted, so to speak. And the United Nations literally were victims to the Inter-Ahmwe mass murderers who hacked them to death. So the whole situation in the film Hotel Rwanda is distorted. They actually have this situation where they make it look like the Canadian colonel, who's a bit of a composite to the UN forces, is trying to save lives. But they were not actually doing it. They were handing the people who had come to the UN for protection over to the Inter-Ahmwe mass murderers. going to Kigali Stadium and finding the journalists, the teachers who were identified for execution, bring them to the gate, hand him over to Intahambwe, who hacked him to death within sight of the UN forces at the gates. And next day, the Intahambwe came back with another list, and the UN went to trouble of finding them too and brought them to gates, and they were hacked to death, and so on. This carried on for weeks. And then there's another film made on the Rwandan genocide, which is Superior, which is Shooting Dogs, also known as Beyond the Gates. And the term Shooting Dogs comes from the British missionary who was asking the UN, why don't you shoot the people murdering the Christians, his congregants, his parish members? And they said, we are under strict orders not to shoot or intervene at all. We are peacekeepers, not peacemakers. And then we are ordered not to intervene. So the term in the film, Shooting Dogs, comes from when the missionary said, then what do you have rifles for? And I said, well, it's to shoot the dogs who try to eat the corpses. So that's where Shooting Dogs comes from. They couldn't shoot the people making the corpses, but they could shoot the dogs who were naturally trying to eat meat in a starvation situation. And you couldn't blame the dogs for the murders, but they were only authorized to shoot the dogs, not to shoot the mass murderers. And that just epitomized the insanity of what was going on. Now, that's a British-made film. Shooting Dogs was filmed entirely in Rwanda on the very site at the ETO school, which was the UN sanctuary base, where the UN evacuated and left the people without warning them, because they were all at mealtime at that time. That as the UN drove out, the Intahambwe mass murderers came pouring in. They were beyond the gates, and they murdered every one of the 2,500 refugees finding skin at UN base. So Shooting Dogs, or Beyond the Gates, and Shake Hands with Devil are two better films on Rwandan genocide, especially as they were filmed in Rwanda and are therefore far more realistic with Rwandese actors, as opposed to Hotel Rwanda, which is Americans and South Africans only, filmed in South Africa, with not one scene from Rwanda, not one Rwandese in the entire film. So Hotel Rwanda's got a good message of a single person making a difference to rescue, being sanctified, or what would you say? It's been sterilized. It's been rid of anything Christian, without identifying who were doing this, why they were doing it, and to whom they were doing it, and making sure there was absolutely no religious or Christian input, prayer, or hymn sing anywhere in the film. So if you want a secular, the Rwandan Holocaust, according to Hollywood, you see Hotel Rwanda. If you want the real story behind the scenes, you see films like Shooting Dogs or Beyond the Gates and Shake Hands with the Devil. And there's the book, Shake Hands with the Devil, and there's my book, Holocaust Rwanda, which documents the big picture. And it's frustrating going to see Hollywood ignoring and misdirecting, ignoring the real story and misdirecting it. It even shows the UN Canadian colonel firing a shot, a warning shot into the ground, mind you, to try and save lives and stop the massacre, which is more than the UN did in the whole of the Rwandan Holocaust. So the Hotel Rwanda tries to salvage the reputation of the United Nations after their catastrophic, disastrous failure. In fact, just to quote Shake Hands with Devil, General Romeo Delia put as a subtitle, humanity's failure. The failure of humanity in Rwanda, not the United Nations failure, not my failure, not Kofi Annan's failure, not the Security Council's failure, humanity's failure. I mean, how's that for evading responsibility and broadening the guilt and blaming everybody for what the UN leadership was personally responsible for? So General Romeo Delia, who is about as authoritative a person as you could get, he was the UN general in charge of the UNIMER peacekeeping force in Rwanda. He said, did we know about the genocide coming? Yes, we did. Could we have stopped it? Yes, we could. Should we have done more? Of course. And he said one of his greatest regrets in his life is that he didn't disobey orders from Kofi Annan and the General Secretary of the UN and save lives. He said, I know I would have spent the rest of my life in prison for having disobeyed orders, but at least I would be able to live with myself. But he ended up being a drunkard, post-traumatic stress disorder person lying on a park benches stoned out of his mind from drugs and drink after the war. And he needs to take a huge regimen of drugs just to stay operationally today, because he has trouble living with himself because he obeyed orders and didn't intervene as was required by his conscience to save lives, but he obeyed orders. And so when he says humanity's failure, he really should be saying the United Nations failure. So I think that Hotel Rwanda has an inspiring look at it, that one person can make a difference, but they ignore the big picture, that there was an anti-Christian genocide where they were wiping out Protestant Christians, Tutsi Christian tribal minority, and that the UN was complicit, and that the French foreign ministry was complicit, and the French even sent in their army to rescue the Interahamwe mass murdering thugs from justice at the hands of their victims. When David beat Goliath and the Tutsis started to take over the country of Rwanda through the Rwandese Patriotic Front, refugees coming in from Uganda to stop the killing, the French Foreign Legion finally was mobilized, not to stop the genocide, but to save the genocidal mass murdering Interahamwe. And they created a cordon sanitaire behind in Operation Turquoise, behind which the Interahamwe could flee, and the RND government's officials and the army, so-called, and they could withdraw into the Congo, into what then was called Zaire, where they could be protected from the consequence of their mass murders. And all the relief aid that had not come to the victims of the genocide suddenly poured in to Zaire and to Tanzania to help the people who did the genocide and their relatives who fled justice. So there's a bigger story that needs to be told, and Hotel Rwanda's more like misdirection than actually revelation. They use a zoom lens to avoid the wide-angle lens of what was actually happening, why it was happening, to whom it was happening, and who was responsible. And particularly, it hides the complicity of the United Nations and the State Department of the US and the French Foreign Ministry and what they did to basically help the perpetrators, the villains, instead of helping the victims. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And you made the point that the term genocide is not one that they like to use. They reserve that for the situation in the Second World War that you touched upon. But actually, I think you meant the word Holocaust, and you've got a story of your own about that, because there is actually a page called on Wikipedia called Rwandan Genocide, but your book is called Holocaust in Rwanda, and I believe that you presented this to a Holocaust museum in America, thinking that it would be well received because it was a museum about Holocausts, but it was not so well received. Can you please let people know when that happened, what happened? I believe you were staying with your friend, the late great Brigadier General Ben Parton, at the time.
That's correct. Well, even before that, I went to a press conference, a press club in Washington, D.C., where I was also taken by General Parton, and I had a journalist get up angry that I used the word Holocaust for Rwanda. That only applied to people in the Second World War of Jewish origin. And I said, well, they were taking Christians alive, throwing them onto massive burning pits. They were literally getting burned alive. I don't know what could qualify as a Holocaust more than what happened in Rwanda, where sometimes entire villages, entire communities and tribes were wiped out through systematic targeting of the Protestant Christian Tutsi minority. And he was so angry, he stormed out of the room. Well, later, General Parton recommended I take my research to the Holocaust Museum in D.C. So I saw my pictures, the original pictures, you know, multiple megabytes, some of these pictures like the piles of skulls outside of the church that I walked in Natarama, where there were 1,200 skulls and skeletons in a single church building, and I waded knee-deep in corpses. So those pictures that I took personally, I put them on CD, high resolution, my book, all the documentation details and so on. I took manager or director of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and he has asked me, why are you giving me this and what relevance is? And I said, isn't this the Holocaust Museum? So at this point, he got very irate and called security and started to escort me out forcibly, like I was insulting him somehow by giving him material that they could use for an exhibit on the Holocaust in Rwanda. And on the way out, I actually saw, and I'm sorry, I was being hustled out, jostled by the security, so I didn't have time to stop and take a picture. But there in the wall, literally carved into the granite of the wall, it was, anti-Semitism began with the birth of Jesus Christ. Now, that's in Washington. I saw when I was in London at the 2014 100th anniversary of the First World War being declared, in the Imperial War Museum, they had a Holocaust exhibit section on that, and as part of the Imperial War Museum. I don't know if it's permanent or was temporary, but I saw this in 2014 and heard it, where they claimed anti-Semitism began with Martin Luther and the Reformation in Germany. Now, that, of course, is outrageous. How you can blame a Bible-believing, God-fearing Christian like Martin Luther for things that secular humanists and National Socialists may have planned or discussed or done in 400 years later seemed outrageous. Nevertheless, how much worse is the American Holocaust Museum in Washington that claims that anti-Semitism began with the birth of Jesus Christ, which of course is slanderous, it's libel, it's false, it's propaganda. But yes, I've had people swear at me for the title Holocaust in Rwanda. And I'm just honestly trying to put forward the stories of the people that I interviewed, the documentation I went through, the Holocaust sites that I witnessed, and it really was a genocide. And it was a genocide in a gun-free land. So I think people need to understand, Rwanda was a gun-free zone. The United Nations disarmed the victims and then stood by and did nothing while the targeted Tutsi minority tribe was systematically for genocide. And it was horrific. And it was traumatic. I got so sick from witnessing this and wading through corpses as I did in Rwanda that I was sick for weeks when I came back, and I had every kind of blood test and scan, and specialists went through it all. And at the end, all they could do was diagnose me as having virus, in brackets, tropical, which my mother, who is a nurse, said means they don't have a clue. So I think it was probably more spiritual. I was exposed to demons and who knows what else was going on there in Rwanda. But the hatred, to try to sleep at night while you're hearing screams and all of the sounds of death and so on around you. My time in Rwanda was very traumatic. And when I tried to put in writing what happened and why it happened, I had journalists swearing at me for the choice of terminology, which is absolutely bizarre. I would have thought, you know, without fear or favor, all the news that's fit to print, shouldn't we be giving the facts and letting people decide on the conclusions of it? I thought that's what good journalism is all about. But back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. And before we go, can you please let the audience know how they can contact you and where they can find your work?
Yes, so our website's www.frontlinemissionsa.org, Frontline Mission SA, short for South Africa. So frontlinemissionsa.org. And you will see on there we've got books like Holocaust in Rwanda available from Christian Liberty Books. And I've got film reviews that I've written on Hotel Rwanda, on Shooting Dogs, and on the Shake Hands with Devil. I strongly recommend Shake Hands with Devil and Shooting Dogs if you want a better perspective on the Rwandan Holocaust in a film, dramatic film version. My personal email is peter@frontline.org.za, or as the Americans say, ZA. So frontline.org.za, peter@frontline.org.za. That's my personal email address. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Peter. And that brings us to the end of today's program. So I want to remind everybody that Peter and I will be back next Tuesday with the book of Zephaniah. I'll be back tomorrow with a solo show. And until then, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day and bye for now.